This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to read from the first chapter of the book of Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy by Sumner Mattison. This first chapter is about Increase Lapham. But I first want to return to a topic we discussed during the recent pledge drive with Laura Erickson, who is the host of For the Birds, which I'm honored to follow every Tuesday morning around 8:30 during Second Cup of Coffee. And the topic that we were discussing is bird-friendly coffee. In her book, 101 Ways to Help Birds, she lists buying bird-friendly coffee as the number one thing. And that's not an accident that she put that at number one. It means nothing less than saving habitat for tropical birds and the winter home of our long-distant migrants that we love here, the orioles, hummingbirds, rose-breasted grosbeaks, the wood thrushes, the barn swallows, and scarlet tanagers. Forest habitat is destroyed by most coffee and cocoa growing, but bird-friendly coffee and cocoa growing does not. We can support this, and we can spread the word. I was sorry to hear Laura Erickson say that coffee can be labeled shade-grown when the trees are grown on cleared land under shade cloth. Older variety of coffee trees used to be grown under the shade of the rainforest trees overhead and could be grown there without impacting the existing forest. But newer, more popular varieties of coffee trees are grown in full sun, which means that forest trees are cut down for the huge and growing market for coffee. I was very happy to hear that we can buy certified bird-friendly coffee from our local organization, Valley Stewardship Network, located just a little north of the theater on Main Street, Viroqua. They also have coffee beans for sale at the farmers market in Viroqua and at special events. Call them for more information at 637-3615. That's 608-637-3615. The certification is done by the Smithsonian Institution. The Smithsonian Bird Friendly Certification is the environmental gold standard in sustainable coffee. They send people to inspect where and how the coffee is grown. Bird friendly coffee is coffee that comes from family farms in Latin America that provide good forest-like habitat for birds. Rather than being grown on farms that have been cleared of vegetation, bird-friendly coffees are planted under a canopy of trees. These trees provide the shelter and food and homes migratory and local birds need to survive. This certification has been extended to cocoa production as well. I think because few of us want to give up coffee or chocolate, it's important to know that we are helping to maintain the habitat that our birds need at the southern end of their migratory lives. There's a very short but very interesting video about the importance of our buying these certified products. Good search words are bird-friendly coffee, Smithsonian, and you'll find a website that has a wealth of information. The certification is a project of the Smithsonian Institute Migratory Bird Center. Let's all follow up on this and start to supply ourselves with coffee that helps the birds we love. I want to thank Laura Erickson for making the trip here from Duluth to help us with our fundraiser, and lots of people got to meet her. It was a great fun time. I'll post links where you can buy fresh bird-friendly coffee on the archived podcast on WDRT.org. Look for Natural Wonders. And be sure to look at lauraerickson.com to see the wealth of information there and to purchase her books. Now on to A Field. I'll be reading portions of the first chapter about Increase Lapham. Sumner describes him in the first paragraph of the chapter. Apart from Native Americans who were the first to know Wisconsin's natural history, there was one who many argue was Wisconsin's premier naturalist, Increase Allen Lapham, the first to promote the state's natural history well beyond the state's borders. Wiry, quiet, unassuming, this self-trained scholar possessed an inexhaustible passion to understand and catalog the natural world. Today, Increased Lapham is widely recognized as Wisconsin's most accomplished pioneering naturalist, working at a time preceding and following statehood, and initiating investigations into the state's botany, geology, topography, geography, ichthyology, meteorology, history, forestry, and archaeology. The Smithsonian Institution published his work on effigy mounds in 1855, the highly acclaimed The Antiquities of Wisconsin. He arrived in Wisconsin in 1836. Lapham traveled widely right off the bat when he first arrived in Milwaukee. He was hired to build a canal to the lead mining region. That project he spent quite a bit of time on, but then the railroad became much more efficient. He recognized that right away. So he turned to many other pursuits. Lapham learned of deaths of beloved family members weeks after the fact in letters and felt so far from his family in Ohio, as expressed in letters during these first 10 years in Wisconsin. And Sumner writes, "Always Lapham returned to public discourse and natural history study to lessen his grief over a family loss. He was in high demand as a public speaker. On February 4, 1848, Increase appeared at the Unitarian Church in Milwaukee to give a lecture to the Milwaukee High School on Wisconsin's diverse landscapes and natural beauty. Here are some excerpts from that lecture, with particular attention to the traveling hardships posed by the extensive prairies of the time. Our oak openings, as they are called, afford much scenery of extreme beauty. Thousands of dollars have been expended in European countries to adorn and beautify the estates of the noble and wealthy classes without producing anything more than a slight approximation towards the beauty and loveliness of our oak openings. I have spoken of the beauty of the prairies, but it must not be forgotten that although they are beautiful and highly attractive at first sight, they are not, after all, exactly the places for the new settler to fix upon for his future home, unless he can find what is rarely to be found, a tract of land half covered with timber and half prairie. Upon the first settlement of the country, much search was made for such farms, and a few were so fortunate as to find them. But in general, it was ascertained that the line of separation between the prairies and the timber was rather an infinite one. Nature here, as in most other cases, has so graduated one kind into the other that it is difficult to say precisely where one begins and the other ends, the prairie being usually surrounded by scattered trees and shrubs. Hence, a farm to be in the prairie must be a very extensive one if it also embraces much woodland. The bleak winds of winter roam over these proud prairies with as much freedom as upon old ocean itself, and they are here without the modifying influence of water. They are therefore much dreaded by the luckless persons who are compelled to encounter them. Even in summer, the constant stream of air coming in the same direction, unchecked by a single tree, is very inconvenient to persons passing over the prairies. I have known persons to have their cheeks chafed and become sore by the fluttering of their shirt collars while traveling on the prairies. This was, of course, in the prosperous days of shirt collars and before they assumed their present downward tendency. In winters, when there is much snow, the prairies present many inconveniences. The free scope allowed for the wind is extended also to the snow, which never lies still where it falls, but is constantly drifted about from place to place. The slopes and summits of the knolls and ridges will be bare of snow, while the hollows and low places will be covered to great depths. Grains, therefore, sown upon the prairie land are either not protected by snow from the effects of the severe frosts, or they are covered with too much snow. From this cause, also, the prairie roads, so fine in summer, are an abomination in winter. A strong wind blowing constantly in one's face, when the thermometer is anywhere in the neighborhood of zero, is not to be supported by many people, but must often be encountered on the prairies. Many persons have lost their lives in this encounter, and it is found to be especially dangerous on those roads which most abound in licensed taverns. The track of the road in winter can never be smooth and well beaten, as in timbered land. The track made by your sleigh is soon filled with drifted snow. Other sleighs following in the same track beat down this additional snow and make other tracks to be again filled and again beaten down. Hence, every sleigh has to break for itself a new track, which is a very real inconvenience, as all know who have attempted it. The result of this process is that in a short time, if there is much travel along the road, it becomes a high ridge of hard-beaten snow, just wide enough for your team, with soft snowbanks on each side. A team with much of a load is constantly liable to be thrown off on either side and tumbled over into a soft snowbank some 4 or 6 feet deep. These inconveniences, with the want of timber, the liability of fires, and so on, make the prairies less desirable than they are usually supposed to be. And Sumner writes, increases occasional poking, but always informative, letters to Brother Darius continued, and this is February 1848. Dear Brother, it is now a long time since we have heard from you directly, and when we did hear, your communication being an effort at poetry was not as full and comprehensive as we could wish. We have had a remarkably mild winter here. No sleighing. The north winds, even, are not very cold. The ice has left our river, being a month earlier than usual. I have a prospect of being employed by the legislature to draw some large maps of the new state of Wisconsin. If so, I shall probably visit all the county seats for the purpose of collecting data. I don't know of any other honors to be conferred on me about which to write, so I must stop here. Plank roads are all the go here now. We shall probably have some before 1 year goes by. Railroads are lost sight of at present. Love to all from your affectionate brother and sister, I. A. Lapham and Ann. And to his brother Darius, March of 1848. Dear Brother, this year is to be one of the great events in Wisconsin. We have just adopted a state constitution, and the whole system of political machinery is about to be put in motion here. Caucuses and conventions are the order of the day. Next week, we shall elect town and city officers throughout the state. In May, we elect governor, members of the first state legislature, and so on. In about 3 weeks, we will be connected by the telegraph wires by way of Cleveland with your city, when, in cases of enough importance, we can communicate without loss of time. The gap between Michigan City and Kalamazoo is all that remains, and this is nearly closed up. We all send our love and regards for you and yours, your brother, I. A. Lapham. And another letter to Darius, and this is August of 1848. I own that I have been remiss in my duty in regards to writing letters this summer. A few days ago, I went with Colonel Stone, my brother-in-law, by way of East Troy, Janesville, and Madison to the Blue Mounds, which we ascended and enjoyed a view of some 50 miles radius in every direction. The mound is a little mountain, being 1,000 feet above the Wisconsin River, a few miles to the north of it. It appears to be composed of a hard, flinty rock, which has remained while all of the soft limestone around it has been carried away in the course of numerous geological ages. I found several new plants there. The trees look stunted and have quite an alpine appearance. Coming home, I got some stalactites from the newly discovered cave, but I did not go into the cave. It has been explored about 1,000 feet and extends further. It is evidently the bed of a subterranean river of muddy water, the stalactites being black and muddy throughout. My best regards to all, your brother, I. A. Lapham. And Sumner writes, the year 1850 was an eventful but sad one for Increase. It started well enough with several sojourns, including one noted in his journal. May 30th, traced the ancient lake beach south from Kenosha to the state line and 4 miles south. At that point, a series of ancient mounds are built upon it. The prairies west of Kenosha, on which we drove in the afternoon, are diluvial. No rock is found. Near the middle of Section 5 in Salem, we came upon some abrupt gravel knolls similar to those found about Delafield and elsewhere. On one of those were some ancient works commanding a view of Silver Lake in the town of Salem, Kenosha County, and the fine valley in which it rests. We were told this evening of an Indian practice to secure horse blocks, or a step by which women and children can conveniently mount their horses. A small tree is selected by the side of the trail, which is cut and bent in two places. The cut is about 2 feet above the ground. This is done without destroying the life of the tree, so that in a few years the sapling becomes a tree large enough to use for the purpose indicated. Such trees I have often observed without knowing their origin, but suppose them accidental freaks of nature. They are said to be very common along the trail. And Sumner writes, a later trip to the upper Mississippi elicited a rhapsodic description in a paper he wrote for a publication titled The Northwest Journal Science and Education. And this is Lapham. No part of the United States, not even the world-renowned Hudson, exceeds the valley of the upper Mississippi in the beauty of its scenery. From the south line of the state to the Minnesota Falls of St. Anthony, there is one continued series of fine, picturesque bluffs and hills of continually varied form and feature. Here are prominent cliffs surmounting gentle grassy slopes. The calm and placid waters of the Mississippi, here of crystal purity, winding its way among the hills, a charming admixture of prairie, with here and there groups of trees of native growth, sturdy oak intermixed with spire-topped evergreens, all well calculated to excite the most agreeable emotions in the mind of the beholder. And Sumner continues, around this time, however, Increase received very sad news. Darius had fallen ill and passed away in late July, a death that left Increase no doubt bereft and inconsolable. Darius shared a similar deft sense of humor and appreciation for all things wild. Increase looked forward to sharing his explorations with him like no other. The only reference to his passing came from a short journal entry. My brother Darius died of cholera at Cincinnati, 20th of July, 1850, and was buried at the home farm, Mount Tabor, in Champaign County, Ohio. Increase's primary family focus in letters then became wife Anne Marie, to whom he wrote whenever away from home for more than a few days. The following letter, penned 1 week before Darius's death, displayed his self-deprecating sense of humor and boundless love for adventure as he descended into a lead mine. My dear wife, we have been separated so much of late that I begin to feel that we are quite strangers. I want to renew the acquaintance. Writing letters is a poor substitute for personal acquaintance. You certainly would not have owned me as a husband if you could have seen me last evening in a miner's trousers, frocked cap, the cap just fitted to cover the hair made of deerskin. I put 1 foot in a loop at the end of a strong rope and was lowered 56 feet into the earth by a windlass. John could not be persuaded to go down. His courage failed him. I wish you had been there to go down, too. I know you would have enjoyed it. It was so romantic. I went down to a drift or horizontal opening about 200 feet long that I went through on all fours. It was only 3 feet high. Hit my back against the sharp points of the roof. It was dark as midnight. Had a candle set in the soft clay for a candlestick so that I could stick it down when and where I pleased. Came out covered with mud and dirt and loaded with specimens, all the more valuable for having mined them myself. In a small sketch, see that man tugging away at the windlass. My life, the happiness of my whole family, hangs upon his nerve. Never fear, he is used to it. I stop at every change of rock to study the geology of the mine. No thought of danger. Am now safe again, your loving husband, Increase A. Lapham. And I'll stop there and continue again next time, reading about Increase Lapham.
From the Book of Field by Sumner Madison. Please check out the archives of this show at wdrt.org, archived podcasts. And remember my spring motto, leave ramps in the woods.
This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks so much for listening.